1961, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered a powerful message to a Lynchburg, Virginia audience, challenging them to actively participate in changing the course of America. It was one of a series of addresses directed to black audiences across the South as a part of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference People to People Tour. Dr. King, speaking in a determined and deliberate voice, painted a vivid picture of the inequities and injustices he had witnessed and experienced in Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi. He instructed his listeners to act collectively and to pursue a nonviolent direct action approach to solving the problems of segregation and discrimination. In outlining his nonviolent course of action, he stressed the need for black people to register and vote, to work for fair legislation, and to work through the courts to gain their rights. The message Dr. King preached some 20 years ago is still meaningful and compelling for us today. We must continue to work to make his dream of America a living reality for all citizens.
Thank you very kindly for your heartwarming applause, and I want to express my deep personal appreciation to my good friend and close associate in the struggle for freedom for these very kind and gracious words of introduction. I need not pause to say how very delighted I am to be here in the city of Lynchburg and the state of Virginia, and to join my colleagues in bringing the People to People tour of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to this community and to this state. We have a great deal to be thankful for, and certainly we are grateful to our many friends and our many co-workers in this state, from the president of the state Southern Christian Leadership Conference of Virginia, Dr. Milton Reed, and the presidents of our various affiliate organizations throughout the state, for making our visit so enjoyable and meaningful, and for all of the courtesies extended. And I know that after we leave, we will be able to go on to the next state, knowing that some very significant gains have been made here in the state of Virginia. I must express my personal appreciation to your leader and our friend, the Reverend Virgil Wood, for the great leadership that he has given to this community in this tense period of transition. And I must also express my appreciation to you in this community who have worked with him and who worked in such an untiring manner to grapple with the problems here and to break down the barriers of segregation and discrimination. And may I say to you that you have my prayers, my moral support, and all of the support that I can possibly give as you continue in the days ahead, whether you are facing court trials, whether you are facing other trying moments, we want you to know that we are with you. We bring greetings to you from the deeper South. I say the deeper South because I don't want you to feel that Virginia is not in the South. But I bring greetings from the part of the South where we live at this time in the state of Georgia and where we lived a few years ago in the state of Alabama. The cradle of the Confederacy, Montgomery, Alabama, was a community where I lived some 5 or 6 years along with Reverend Ralph Abernathy. And I can never address any audience in this country or out of the country without bringing just a word of greetings from Montgomery, Alabama. For it was in Montgomery that a mighty struggle took place. And I bring special greetings to you from the 50,000 Negro citizens of Montgomery who came to see back in 1955 on the 5th of December that it is ultimately more honorable to walk in dignity than ride in humiliation. And certainly as a result of their willingness to substitute tired feet for tired souls, they were able to break down the barriers of bus segregation. And I'm happy to report that today in Montgomery, Alabama, a Negro passenger can sit anywhere on the bus that he wants to sit and where a seat is available. This is because of that struggle, and this struggle could not have taken place, and we could not have continued the struggle without the support and backing of people all over America. For as we walk the streets of Montgomery, we realize that we did not walk alone, for hundreds and millions of people walked with us. And above all, God walked with us. And this was the encouragement that we had all along. Now for the moments left, and I would like to say, as Reverend Wood has already said, that after my message, we want everybody here to remain for just a few minutes, for we have a message for you, an important message, which will come from the lips of one of the eloquent prophets of our struggle. And we want you to remain for that word and that message. But I want to talk with you tonight. And I want to be as brief as possible, and I know briefness would always be a magnificent accomplishment for a Baptist preacher. But I want to try to be as brief as possible and talk with you on a theme that is very dear to my heart, and I believe a theme that is dear to the heart of every devoted American assemble here tonight. I want to talk about the American dream. For this is what we are trying to do in our struggle. We are trying to make the American dream a reality. And we need not look very far, we need not utter many words to find the expression of this American dream. We can just turn back to 1776 and read the words that were penned by a man that once lived in this state. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This, in brief, is the American dream. And one of the first things we notice about this dream is its amazing universalism. It does not say some men, but it says all men. It does not say all white men, but it says all men, which includes black men. It doesn't say all Gentiles, but it says all men, which includes Jews. It doesn't even say all Protestants, but it says all men, which includes Catholics. That is something else at the center of that dream, which is one of the things that distinguishes democracy from totalitarianism. These rights are neither derived from or conferred by the state. In order to discover where they came from, it is necessary to move back behind the dim mist of eternity. They are God-given. Very seldom, if ever, in the history of the world has a socio-political document expressed in such profound, eloquent, and unequivocal language the dignity and the worth of human personality. But the American dream reminds us that every man is the heir of a legacy of dignity and worth. This is the meaning of the American dream. But ever since the founding fathers of our nation dreamed this dream, to use a big word that is used by psychiatrists or psychologists, America has been a schizophrenic personality, tragically divided against herself. On the one hand, we have proudly professed the great principles of democracy. But on the other hand, the nation has sadly practiced the very opposite of those principles. Indeed, slavery and segregation have always been strange paradoxes in a nation founded on the principle that all men are created equal. And that is something tragically wrong with a nation that is spending billions of dollars and is making speedy plans to get a man on the moon and has no plans to get a Negro in the state legislature of Virginia. But now more than ever before, America is challenged in the move for justice and capitulating to the undemocratic practices of the guardians of a deadening status quo. Then moderation is a tragic vice which all men of goodwill must condemn. We can't afford to slow up. We love America too much to slow up. When we look around the world, We think of the fact that there are some 2,700,000,000 people in this world. Vast majority of these people live in Asia and in Africa. For years they've been dominated politically, exploited economically, segregated and humiliated by some foreign power. Today they're gaining their independence, and they're saying in no uncertain terms that racism and colonialism must go. And they are making it clear that they will not follow any nation that will subject a segment of its citizenry on the basis of race or color. And so I can only say in figurative language that the motor is now cranked up, and we are moving up the highway of freedom toward the city of equality. And we can't afford to stop now, because our nation has a date with destiny. We must keep moving. So those of us who are working all across the South, whether we be Negro or white, those of us who are working all across the nation to make the American dream a reality, are engaged in the most significant work of this age, for we are seeking to save the soul of the United States of America. This is our mission. And if we succeed, America succeeds. If we fail, America fails. This is what we must get over, over and over again. Now, what are some of the things that we must do in order to make this dream a reality? First, I want to suggest to you that we must continue courageously to challenge the system of segregation. Now, you know about segregation in Virginia, and we know about it in Georgia, and we know about it all over the United States, because segregation is a glaring reality today. Some years ago, in 1896, the Supreme Court of our nation rendered a decision known as the Plessy versus Ferguson decision. Now, this decision established the doctrine of separate but equal as the law of the land. But we all know what happened as a result of that old Plessy doctrine. There was always a strict enforcement of the separate without the slightest intention to abide by the equal. And so the Negro ended up being plunged into the abyss of exploitation, where he experienced the bleakness of nagging injustice. Then we came to see something, and we see it today more than ever before, and that is that that is something evil, and that that is something morally wrong with this idea of racial segregation of separate but equal. And all over this nation now, there are those humble souls who are coming to see that segregation is a cancer in the body politic, which must be removed before our democratic and moral health can be realized. There are those who have the vision to see now that segregation is nothing but a new form of slavery covered up with certain niceties of complexity. And the separate can never be equal in race relations. I remember some few years ago when I was still living in Montgomery, Alabama. I had a speaking commitment in Norfolk, Virginia. And I took a flight out of Montgomery and went on to Atlanta, Georgia, and then I changed planes in Atlanta to get to Norfolk. I took a Capital Airlines flight. At that time it was Capital. Now it has merged with United, but it was Capital then, and I got on the flight, and we started out from Norfolk and developed a little motor trouble and turned around and came back to Atlanta. And of course, I was very happy to get back. Whenever these planes develop motor trouble, it's always a great experience to get back on the ground. Now, I don't want to give anybody here the impression tonight that I don't have faith in God in the air. It's simply that I've had more experience with him on the ground. But we got back to the Atlanta airport. We got back and discovered that we had to stay some 2 hours and a half while they repaired the aircraft. And they gave all of us tickets to get our dinner in the Dobbs House in the Atlanta airport. Now, at that time, the Dobbs House was still segregated. We all had our tickets, and I got my ticket like everybody else and went on in the Dobbs House and took a seat like everybody else. I saw that the Dobbs House was made for people to eat in, and I thought that I was probably a person, although many things tried to remind me that I wasn't in our society, but I felt that I was, so I decided I would sit down in the Dobbs House with everybody else. And as soon as I took my seat, the hostess came over and she said, we can't serve you here, but we do have a place right back in the back where we can serve you if you will come right back. I said, no, this is fine right here. I don't. And then she went on and she said, now this is terribly embarrassing, but you know the law. You know the law, and we can't serve you here. I said, well, I certainly can't eat behind those curtains there. I said, do you mind if I talk with the manager? She said, yes, it's all right. And she went and got the manager, and he came out, and he started talking. And in the process, he said, I believe you're Reverend Martin Luther King. And I said, yes, I am. Now, Reverend, You are supposed to be a law-abiding citizen. And now you know the law. This is just the law. We didn't make these laws, Reverend. And the law in this state and in this city said that the races must be separate. And we have a fine place provided for you back there. And he made this statement. He said, now, Reverend, the food is the same. And, Reverend, if you just try it back there, you discover that they're going to serve you in the same plates and the table back there is just like these tables out here, Reverend. And he said, in fact, it's better back there, Reverend. You'll get served sooner. You'll be the only one back there. So we had a nice conversation, and I said, well, let me say two or three things to you, if you don't mind. I said, I just want to discuss this issue, and I said, it's wonderful that we are communicating. One of the tragedies of the South is that we are still trying to live in monologue rather than dialogue. We've got to talk together more. So we started talking together. And I said, now let me tell you why I believe that it's wrong for me to sit there, back there, and that it's not equal back there. I said, now first, a man got on the plane in Mobile, Alabama, and the plane stopped in Montgomery, and I got on, and I took a seat by this man. He's a white man. And we started talking about several problems, and this man is in here now, and we want to continue that conversation. Now, I can't talk with that man if I got to go back there in the back behind that curtain. I said, so now you have inflicted inequality in the realm of communication. And if I can't communicate with a man, I'm not equal to him. I said, now that's the first level of inequality. I said, now the other thing is that I don't like sitting back behind curtains. It does something to my soul. And the danger of it is that I might get bitter in the process, so that you have inflicted upon me the possibility of a greater accumulation of bitterness. And And so it is inequality in the realm of the potentiality for the greater accumulation of bitterness. And I said, as a third thing that bothers me, you see all these beautiful paintings around here? You got them all over these walls. Beautiful paintings. And I like them. They have moved my aesthetic faculty, and now you're going to put me behind a curtain and I can't see them. So that you have inflicted upon me aesthetic inequality. I'm saying all of this to say to you, my friends, that the Supreme Court was eminently correct in 1954 when it said, oh, Plessy Doctrine must go. That separate facilities are inherently unequal, and that to segregate a child on the basis of his race is to deny that child equal protection of the law. The Supreme Court discovered that there can never be something called separate but equal, because the separate is always unequal in the area of race relations and separate facilities. All over this United States, we must stand up against segregation, realizing that as we stand up against it, we are not just against something to be standing up against it. We are not for integration just because this seems to be the thing that is taking place on the stage of history in a sociological transition. We must stand up for integration because, in a real sense, this is what God stands up for. Some of the great theologians and philosophers have sought to define God. When they came to that definition, they started seeing God as something working for integration. And so when Jan Smuts defined God, he said he's a principle of holism. And Henry Nelson Wyman defined God, he said he's a process of integration. And Alfred North Whitehead defined God, he says he's a principle of concretion. And whenever we think of God, we think of a power working at every moment to bring together the disconnected aspects of reality into a harmonious whole. Yes, integration is more than something we are talking about, but it is a part of the edicts of God himself. This is what we are struggling for. So when we talk about integration, we are talking about something that the universe is working toward. And we must work with determination to end the evil system of segregation. The second thing that we must do to make the American dream a reality is to work passionately and unrelentingly to double the number of Negro voters in the South. I have said before, and I reiterate, that one of the most significant steps that the Negro can take at this hour is that short walk to the voting booth. Let nobody fool you. Even politicians respect votes. Even Senator Byrd respects votes. Now we have about 1,300,000 Negroes registered to vote in the South. There are a little more than 5 million Negroes who are eligible to vote. You can see that we have a long, long way to go. And just think of what we could do if we had 3 million or 4 million Negroes registered to vote. Number one, we would be able to liberalize the political structure of the South. And from that point, we would be able to liberalize the political structure of this nation. What is it that blocks every liberal move in civil rights legislation? It is a vicious coalition in Congress made up of Southern Dixiecrats and right-wing reactionary Northern Republicans. And they join together and unite and defeat almost every liberal move in the area of civil rights. And not only in civil rights, in other legislation, social welfare legislation, labor law, or any other liberal legislation, it is this coalition that gets together and defeats it. Now, how can this coalition be defeated? I believe firmly that the increased registration on the part of Negroes in the South will defeat this evil coalition in Congress. And we must go out to do it. Think of the fact that I'll take Mississippi as an example. Senator Eastland is often elected with less than 100,000 votes. Just think of this. His colleague in the Senate from a state like Connecticut, which is about the same size as Mississippi population-wise, is elected with 1 million votes. Now, is this democracy? Now, why is it that Senator Eastland can be elected with less than 100,000 votes? Number one, you have in Mississippi about 20,000 Negroes registered to vote, and there are almost 1 million Negroes in the state of Mississippi. Think of this. And then even a lot of the white people are blocked from voting because they have something that Virginia has, namely the poll tax. And the poll tax has served as a conniving scheme to keep the electorate small. And it has served to block the freedom, not only of the Negro, but the white man. And we must make it clear that as we struggle to gain the ballot and to make the American dream real, we are not struggling merely to free the Negro, but we are struggling to free the white man, for he's also a slave under this system. So we must struggle with determination to get the ballot, and this is what we are trying to do on this People to People tour. This is what we are trying to do through the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And we ask you to work here in this community and all over the state of Virginia with determination to get this job done. And it will make a great difference in our move to make the American dream a reality. The other thing I'd like to mention is this. We must make full and constructive use of the freedom we already possess. We need not wait until the day of full emancipation before we make a contribution to the life of our nation. We must not use our oppression as an excuse for laziness. I know the temptation, and I know how we've been trampled over with iron feet of oppression. And that is always a temptation to say that since we've been the victims of social isolation, economic deprivation so long, that we can't be anybody. Somewhere along the way, we must, in spite of this system, develop a sense of somebodiness and discover that human nature cannot be cataloged. For history has proven that inner determination can often break through the outer shackles of circumstance. Take the Jews, for example. For years they've been exploited, trampled over. They've walked through the fires of persecution. But in the midst of this, they've risen up to plunge against cloud-filled nights of oppression, new and blazing stars of inspiration. And so being a Jew did not keep Einstein from using his genius-packed mind to challenge an axiom and leave for the lofty insights of science a theory of relativity. Being Jews did not keep Amos and Hosea, Jeremiah and Isaiah, from standing up in the midst of the unjust conditions of their day, and declare to men the eternal word of the Almighty God. And I say, being a Negro does not have to keep us from rising up at this moment. And we already have numerous and inspiring examples of Negroes who have proved that we need not wait. So from a slave cabin this very state of Virginia, Booker T. Washington rose up to be one of America's great leaders. He lit a torch in Alabama and darkness fled.
Yes, sir.
From the red hills of Gordon County, Georgia, and the arms of a mother who could neither read nor write, Roland Hayes rose up to be one of the world's great singers.
Yes, sir.
He carried his melodious voice into the palace of King George V and the mansion of Queen Mother of Spain. Humble, poverty-stricken conditions in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Marian Anderson rose up to be the world's greatest contralto, so that a Toscanini could say a voice like this comes only once in a century. And Sibelius of Finland cried out, "My roof is too low for such a voice." From humble, poverty-stricken circumstances, George Washington Carver rose up, carved for himself an imperishable niche in the annals of science. There was a star in the sky to female leadership. And then came Mary McLeod Bethune and grabbed it and allowed it to shine in her life in all of its radiant beauty. There was a star in the diplomatic sky. And then came Ralph Bunch, the grandson of a slave preacher, and allowed it to shine in his life with all of its radiant beauty. All of these people have come to tell us that we need not wait. And they've justified the conviction of the poet, fleecy locks and black complexion cannot forfeit nature's claim. Skin may differ, but affection dwells in black and white the same. Why so tall as to reach the pole, or to grasp the ocean at a span, I must be measured by my soul. The mind is the standard of the man. This is what they've chosen for. Now, there's one other point that I want to bring out. We are to make the American dream a reality. We must continue to engage in creative protest in order to break down the barriers of segregation and discrimination. Now, there's somebody here tonight. I don't know your name, but you're in here. There's somebody in here tonight who is living with a strange illusion and a strange myth, and that is that you can sit down and do nothing and this problem will work itself out. Just wait and it'll work itself out. And you've heard this myth, the myth of time. Just let time take care of it. President Eisenhower used to say that. I heard him say it one time, that this problem to be solved will take the time that history will afford it to be solved. And I say to you that time is neutral. It can be used constructively or destructively. And I'm convinced tonight that some of the segregationists have used time much more effectively than the people of goodwill. And it may well be that we will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words of the bad people, but for the appalling silence of the good people.
Yes,
they have been sitting down waiting on time. We must remember that somewhere along the way, we must help time. And that human progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. Comes through the tireless efforts and the dedicated work of devoted individuals, and without this hard work, time itself becomes the ally of the primitive forces of social stagnation. We must remember that the time is always ripe to do right. Somehow we must use it creatively. And I say also that there's another illusion that some of us have. And that is that only education can solve this problem. We've heard that. Now, there's a half-truth involved here because education does have a great role to play. But those who use this argument use it to say not only education can solve it, not legislation. You've heard that. So don't be going up talking about legislation throughout the South and civil rights legislation. It's going to take the slow process of education to change attitudes. Now, there is some truth in this. But even though morality cannot be legislated, behavior can be regulated. You see, the law may not make a man love me. Religion and education must do that. But it can keep him from lynching me, and I think that's pretty important also. So that even though legislation may not change the heart, it can restrain the heartless. And this is what we must continue to see as we move on in this struggle. So we've got to continue to work through legislation. We've got to continue to work through the courts. The day of litigation is not over. We've got to continue to work through the courts to gain our rights. But then that is another thing that I want to leave with you tonight before leaving. A court order can only declare rights. It can never deliver them. And only when the people themselves begin to act are the rights which are on paper given lifeblood. Only when the people in mass begin to act are they able to make all of these laws real and meaningful. And so each of you here tonight must decide as an individual to be a sort of creative obstetrician presiding at the birth of a new age. You must stand up and sit down and ride in and walk in and any other kind of in necessary in order to solve this problem which faces America. In other words, we must supplement what we do through the courts and through legislation with nonviolent direct action. Now, there are several things about this method that make it powerful. Number one, it has a way of disarming the opponent. Weakens his morale, it exposes his moral defenses, and at the same time it works on his conscience and he just doesn't know what to do. Now I can assure you that if we rose up with violence in the South, our opponents would really know what to do because they know how to operate on this level. They are tacticians and strategists and everything else on this level. See, they control all the forces of violence, and you know, you don't have a single Negro in the National Guard in the South. I used to hear somebody talk about the Negroes who use violence in the struggle, and I got to thinking, well, where in the world are we going to get the weapons to compete with a National Guard that doesn't even have a single Negro in it? Violence in our struggle is not only immoral, and I think that's the basic reason, but it's also impractical. But that is something about this non-violent approach that disarms the opponent and it leaves him frustrated and he doesn't know what to do. If he beats you, you have developed the power to accept it without retaliating. If he doesn't beat you, fine. If he throws you in jail in the process, you go on in there and transform the jail from a dungeon of shame to a haven of freedom and human dignity. Even if he tries to kill you, you develop the quiet courage of dying if necessary without killing. And so you leave him disarmed, not knowing what to do, and he ends up frustrated and disillusioned. This is the power of nonviolence. There's another thing about it. It helps you to work for something that's morally right, namely integration in the brotherhood of man with methods that are morally right. In other words, it helps you to secure moral ends with moral means. And one of the great discussions of history has been this whole question of means and ends. And there have been those individuals who argue that the end justifies the means. I think if that is any weakness and any tragedy of communism, it is right here. Communism lives with a philosophy that the end justifies the means. Go back and read Lenin and hear him saying that lying, deceit, And even violence are justifiable methods to bring about the end of the classless society. But this is where nonviolence breaks with communism and any other philosophy that says that the end justifies the means. The end is pre-existent in the means and in the long run of history. Destructive methods cannot bring about constructive ends. In the long run of history, immoral means cannot bring about moral ends. And we have a method now where we can struggle to secure moral ends with moral means. And that is another thing about this method. It says that as you struggle, you can be determined, you can be courageous, you can stand up against the system, and yet you don't even have to hate the perpetrators of that unjust system. Oh, isn't it a wonderful thing to have ourselves reminded over and over again that we need not hate? Isn't it a wonderful thing to have the insights of our religion to tell us that it is possible for us to stand up against this evil system and yet love those people? Love those people who are using the system to oppress us. Isn't it a wonderful thing to hear the words echoing across the centuries? Love your enemies.
Yeah.
Bless them that curse you. Pray for them that despitefully use you.
Yeah.
Isn't it a wonderful thing to hear somebody say, turn the other cheek? And Jesus realized when he said this, that turning the other cheek meant sometimes that you would have some harm done to you. He didn't feel at any point that turning the other cheek meant that you were escaping danger. Turning the other cheek might mean getting your home bombed. Turning the other cheek may mean getting killed. It may mean getting stabbed and getting your body scarred up. But what he was saying was this, that it is better to go through life with a scarred up body than a scarred up soul.
Yeah.
And somebody must have sense enough in this world. Oh, this evening, if I can leave anything with you here in Lynchburg, if I can leave anything in Virginia, I want to leave the message of love. For I think it is the most durable power in all the world. And this is the only way that we will be able to transform the jangling discords of the South into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. We can't do it through hate. And so we must come to the point of saying to those who would oppress us, do to us what you will and we will still love you. We will match your capacity to inflict suffering with our capacity to endure suffering. We will meet your physical force with soul force. Do to us what you will. Yes, we cannot in all good conscience obey your unjust laws because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. And so throw us in jail, and we will still love you. Bomb our homes and threaten our children, and as difficult as it is, we will still love you. Send your hooded perpetrators of violence into our communities at the midnight hours, and drag us out on some wayside road, and beat us and leave us half dead, and we will still love you. Be ye assured that we will wear you down by our capacity to suffer. And one day we will win our freedom. We will not only win freedom for ourselves, we will so appeal to your heart and your conscience that we will win you in the process. And our victory will be a double victory. This is what we are doing. And I say to you, my friends, as I go on to my conclusion, this method is not at all without successful precedent. It was used in a magnificent way by Mohandas K. Gandhi to free his people from the indignities and the exploitation that they confronted in India. And it has been used in a marvelous way in our own Southland by hundreds and thousands of students. And they have taken our deep groans and our passionate yearnings for freedom and filtered them in their own souls and fashioned them into a creative protest, which is an epic known all over our nation. And as a result of that disciplined, non-violent yet courageous actions, do you realize this evening that they have been able to bring about integration at lunch counters in more than 150 cities of the South? And this is nothing less than revolutionary. This method has been used in the Freedom Rides. We were told to cool off in the Freedom Rides, but there were those who were determined not to cool off. And as a result of the Freedom Rides, almost every bus terminal in the South is now integrated. You have heard of Montgomery, Alabama. Lynn Holt told you about what we went through there. Remember, in that same city where we were locked in a church and couldn't get out, the violent mob stood outside. In that same city where men of violence kicked and beat freedom riders, in that same state where the buses were burned, in that same city of Montgomery, Alabama, Negroes and white people are eating breakfast in the restaurant of the Greyhound bus terminal this day, and they will be tomorrow. And this is as a result of the freedom riders. So we have a powerful method. We have a powerful approach. And I believe that we will be able, if we will use this, we will be able to bring into full realization the ideals and principles of the American dream. This is the challenge I leave with you tonight. And as I go to my seat, let me say something that we should never forget. Before the struggle is won, before the victory is won, some will have to suffer. Let us not run from suffering. But I am convinced now more than ever before there can be something creative in suffering. And just as the cross of Christ has always had value for us in giving us the meaning and the power of suffering, we must see it anew in our struggle. Before the victory is won, some of us will have to get scarred up. Before the victory of brotherhood is won, some more will be thrown in jail. Before the victory for brotherhood is won, somebody will lose a job here and there. Before the victory is won, somebody may even have to face physical death. But if physical death is the price that some must pay to free their children from a permanent life of psychological death, then nothing could be more redemptive. Before the victory is won, some will be misunderstood and dismissed as dangerous rabble-rousers and agitators. And some will be called Reds and Communists simply because they believe in the brotherhood of man. But as Lynn Hope said to us, in spite of all of this, we shall overcome. And I tell you why. We shall overcome because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. We shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crushed to earth will rise again.
Yes,
we shall overcome because James Russell Lowell is right. Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne, yet that scaffold sways the future.
Yes.
And behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. We shall overcome because the Bible is right.
Yes.
You shall reap what you sow. And so if we will go out with that faith, we will be able to move out of the bleak and desolate midnight of man's inhumanity to man into the bright and glittering daybreak of freedom and justice. This will be a great day. This will be the day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last. Free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.